Radio Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. The House version of the state budget was released this week, and all of a sudden, Beacon Hill is sounding a little more like Wisconsin.
The only thing that this budget does is silence the voice of working families. But those voices won't be silent in November of 2012.
And about 2012, Governor Deval Patrick isn't running for the presidency, but he will be a spokesman for his friend, President Barack Obama. Patrick also has a new autobiography out, and he was making the national rounds this week.
I had had to read Barack Obama's life story mm-hmm. before he came on the show. Mm-hmm. So what I did is just searched and replaced your name with his. I hope that's not a problem.
Meanwhile, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour was going a-courtin' at a New Hampshire gun shop. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty is tea partying on Boston Common. And where's Mitt Romney, you ask?
I'm announcing my exploratory committee for the presidency of the United States.
An announcement he made on YouTube and Twitter. So we're going to follow Romney's lead. In 140 characters or less, we are going to announce our exploratory committee.
No!
For the week's news.
Pshaw!
I could not resist. I just couldn't resist. Oh, that committee is, and the tweet begins here. At Radio Boston is David Bernstein, political reporter for the Boston Phoenix, and Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist.
138 characters. Nice.
Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
Welcome to you, Ken.
Thanks.
All right, listeners, so what is your big story of the week? When you hear Mitt Romney is maybe thinking about possibly declaring, but not really, but exploring another run for the presidency, what do you make of that? And also, what do you make of the budget battles, the more serious budget battles on Beacon Hill that regard health care and municipal workers and their right to collectively bargain over healthcare in Massachusetts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Give us a call with your thoughts on the week's news. Okay, so let's start off right now with the presidential hopefuls, I guess is what I can call them now, swarming New Hampshire. We mentioned Mitt Romney. He now joins fellow explorer and former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, who's scheduled to be speaking at a Tea Party tax season rally on Boston Common in just over an hour from now. Also in town this week, actually up in New Hampshire, was Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, as we mentioned. So that trio right there, that, David Bernstein, I believe, makes up your top three picks for a GOP ticket?
Yes, my rankings that I've been doing since the end of the last presidential cycle. I think those are the big three who have a real solid chance to win. But you've got a lot of other candidates, and they're all – this is sort of the week when it's really, really starting up there. You've got Rick Santorum up there. Michelle Bachmann's going to be up there. A bunch of them are swarming the state. It's funny with Mitt Romney announcing the exploratory committee because this is a guy who has been campaigning nonstop for president since 2004. This is his seventh year of it. He's not exploring anything. It's just shifting in how he can raise money and how he can spend money.
Ken Cooper, your take on the Romney presidential machine?
Well, I think he may also be picking up on some weariness in the broader public between perhaps beyond the people here in this room with this nonstop campaigning and is therefore being a little coy, even though those of us who know what he's really up to are not at all at all fooled by this particular action. To David's crew there, I would also throw into the mix Mitch Daniels, mm-hmm. who I think is likelier as a VP candidate cutting the budget and balancing the budget is a big deal in this cycle, as we anticipate, having a running mate who's been the former director of the Office of Management and Budget could be a good thing. I don't see him as a real serious presidential contender. I don't think the country's looking for an accountant in chief, which is pretty much what he would be.
Although with all the focus on the budget, maybe that is eventually what voters might be looking for.
Well, right? And that's certainly I believe that Mitch Daniels is actually my number four on that list.
We're close.
We're right in line. The other thing is he's awfully short. I don't know if you've ever seen him in person. Awfully short to be standing next to Mitt Romney on the stage.
I got my start in journalism in Indiana, and I've interviewed Governor Daniels of many a time, and yes, that is really true. That said, I really don't think he wants it. I really, really don't. Word is that his wife doesn't want him to do it.
His wife really doesn't want him to do it.
But don't they always say that vehemently before then they do?
Yeah.
He's a shockingly sincere guy. Like, he tends to be... he's kind of honest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's
oh, he can't make it. He can't make it.
That's not going to fly. That's not going to fly in a Republican primary. yeah, we'll see. I mean, he's certainly done a very good job of playing this notion to get his name recognition up, his sort of bona fide, so he now looks like a realistic vice presidential candidate or maybe a presidential candidate in 4 years. So whether he's serious about running this time or not, he's certainly done himself some good, or, you know, book sales for, or whatever he wants to do next.
Oh, so, okay, so shockingly sincere candidates aside, I mean, we're also in a sort of a political cycle, a long-term political cycle, where a couple things happen in primaries. One, you get more committed voters. They tend to be the ones who vote in the primaries. And two, it seems as if the more committed voters these days, you know, even up in New Hampshire, are the ones with the more extreme points of view. So how, I mean, Ken and David, how does that position Governor Romney in terms of his attractiveness to the folks who are actually going to vote in the GOP primary?
Well, you know, if the folks who vote in the GOP primary in New Hampshire are overrepresented in that group are people who believe in smaller government, less government spending. It's kind of hard to be a candidate to expanded health care in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, sort of like Barack Obama
right.
intends to do in the federal government. I'm not quite sure how you talk yourself around that one.
Yeah, and his real problem, that the health care reform in Massachusetts, which many on the right are now referring to as Romney-care, to equate it with what they call Obamacare, which is sort of a dirty word in conservative circles. You know, he's got that. And frankly, I think that the problem, because he's having an overwhelming problem dealing with that and being criticized for that in conservative circles, and I think it stems from a distaste for him that's already there. If he was sort of liked and if the establishment was sort of pushing for him, I don't think that they would be as harsh on him and as you know, bringing it up constantly, criticizing him. But he's not very popular. That doesn't mean he can't get over it.
Even though you've written that he may be the candidate that could actually beat President Obama in a general election.
Well, and you know, it's funny because you talk to Republican insiders, and a lot of them believe that. You know, a lot of them say, and frankly, what it comes down to is most likely, if Obama is going to lose, it's going to be because the economy does not recover fast enough. If the economy slows down or we go into a double dip recession, that's what's going to cause voters to reject Obama. And that scenario would put economic leadership and economic knowledge into the forefront of the conversation, which plays to Romney's strengths. His problem is that right now, people aren't talking so much about jobs and the economy. They're talking about other issues, which is not so good for them.
Yeah. So actually, one more question about Governor Romney. I want to open it up to both of you guys. Because, David, you had some points of advice.
That's right, yeah.
For the governor, former governor.
He didn't ask, but I thought.
You offered them, even though, as you said.
And you didn't charge?
There's a lot of free-floating advice going around in presidential primary season. One of them was, I believe you said, get rid of the blue jeans.
I said burn the blue
jeans.
Burn
the blue jeans.
Yeah, see, I think that he, you know, he has this authenticity problem, and it's because he constantly tries to reshape himself to whatever he thinks the people want to hear. I mean, it's legitimately earned, but it's a real problem for him. And what I think he needs to do is he needs to be the businessman, the guy who ran last time, the sort of the front runner type, who everyone comes back to in the end. But to do that, he's got to be himself so that he is that guy when they decide that they don't actually want to nominate, you know, a Michelle Bachmann or a Newt Gingrich.
So that was your other piece of advice. And actually, Ken, what's your thought on this? That, you know, David says, you know, maybe Governor Romney should consider courting a... You used the word.
I said he should help a wingnut.
Help a wingnut. I did not say it. David Bernstein did. In order to catapult, you know, one of the more possibly fringe candidates up so that then the party realizes, oh, my gosh, this is not the person we want to put up against Obama.
Well, got a devious mind there.
I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah.
He may not, you know, have to do that by himself. I mean, given the nature of the Republican primary electorate, one such, whatever word you use, may very well, in fact, bubble up. which will, in fact, make Democrats quite happy if, for example, Newt Gingrich gets a second life or somebody or someone even with less of a track record like Michelle Bachmann. But I don't think Romney has to necessarily do anything to make that happen.
Well, he's also got the money and the money-making prowess to fight a long, hard primary battle all the way through past, you know, the big bunches of primaries we have seemingly earlier and earlier in the calendar every year. But about the power of, you know, these grassroots movements such as the Tea Party and the muscle that they might flex in up in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina, all these early races. We shouldn't forget that, you know, there's obviously a Tea Party right here in Massachusetts and also in New Hampshire. And in Concord earlier today, there was a Tea Party rally that had a whole host of GOP potentials at it. Tim Pawlenty, Herman McCain, Rick Santorum, Buddy Romer. WBUR's reporter Fred Tice was actually up there today, and he spoke to a woman named Naomi Claggett, who explained what she was actually looking for in a candidate.
I think that a sitting governor or perhaps a former governor who has accomplished, who's truly got a record to run on, could waltz. I literally think if they would tell the truth, they could waltz into the White House against Obama. I don't think he would have a chance if Chris Christie would run. So my man is Chris Christie.
So that's a name we haven't mentioned yet. Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, who said, no, I am absolutely positively not running.
Yeah, I have. I refer on my blog to what I call the Al Gore waistline indicator, and that is when someone you watch, and if they're not losing weight, that means they're not preparing to run. That's why I think that Mike Huckabee is not preparing to run. That's how we knew that Haley Barbour was preparing to run.
That's awesome.
Lost a lot
of
weight.
That's so right.
Year. It's absolutely true.
Bill Richardson last time. Yep.
And in fact, Newt Gingrich, who I saw up in New Hampshire a few days ago, still could use to lose a few pounds, but he's trimmer than he was a couple years ago.
But Chris, his hair has gained weight.
it's true. He's a striking figure in many ways. But Chris Christie is not in shape for is not indicating by that measure.
It's not a fighting weight. Yeah.
No.
All right. Well, let's. We have many more months yet to come to discuss presidential politics. So let's move on to
and examine
waistlines and beards and hairs and maybe even hemlines. Who knows? Let's actually move on to a big story happening right here in Massachusetts, and that's of course the state budget. The House has proposed a $30 billion budget this week, but the big news there that we heard a little bit at the top of the segment was the fact that they are proposing changes in how municipalities pay for health insurance plans, co-payments, and deductibles, all without approval from employee unions. So, David Bernstein, that at one time, basically not having collective bargaining for municipal employees over this issue about healthcare, seemed unthinkable in Massachusetts, and yet here it is in the House version of the budget.
Yeah. Actually, I took a little while ago about the comparison between Beacon Hill and Madison, Wisconsin. There was a time when that was a natural comparison before there was a new governor in Wisconsin. I think there is a legitimate problem here about the relatively lower level of cost sharing in terms of co-payments and deductibles that municipal employees in the state have to pay. I don't think the solution is to take away the collective bargaining rights. And lo and behold, the mayor of Boston has, through collective bargaining, got unions in this city to agree to some increases in their cost sharing. Not that I think they're enough. When I read that Boston City employees pay 15% of their insurance premiums, whereas the private industry standard is 20%, edging toward 25%. Adding 2.5% to their 15% goes to the right direction, but probably should be raised some more after that.
And yet, as you said, they agreed to do it through the process of collective bargaining.
Right. And now I've heard the response is that, you know, that some cities aren't strong enough to stand up to these big, bad unions. But I was trying to think of an example when a union couldn't stand up with a big bad company or government that somebody changed the law to level the playing field. I can't think of an example where that happened.
All right. Well, let's listen for a second, if we can, to the voice of someone who represents city government. Here's New Bedford Mayor Scott Lang and his take on this.
You work for the city, and you walk out of your house and you look around, and in your neighborhood, everyone has a less of a health care plan than you do, and it costs more. At a certain point, you're going to realize that those are the people who pay for it.
We actually have a caller right on this topic. Let's go to Newton, and John is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
My thought is I'm a teacher. I've been teaching for 16 years now, and I think it's appalling what has been proposed. You know, a deal's a deal. And that, you know, we have bargained with our city for, you know, years and years, and we have gotten 0% raises. At the end of the 90s, I got a 1% raise. 1%. How many people got a 1% raise in 1999?
John,
it just doesn't happen. We gave up, you know, quite a bit to keep our, you know, keep our health care low. And, you know, I hear about these $5 copays. I don't know a single educator that has a $5 copay.
Just out of curiosity, John, what is your copay right now?
$20.
$20. Okay, I guess that seems pretty standard. But you know, but in the big picture here, John, I mean, what we've been talking about, it also has to do with the fact that healthcare costs overall are rising. And I understand that many union members feel like they have deferred their benefits. But would you be willing to just take a look at this one part of collective bargaining and say maybe there's some room to give?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, you know, you go into public service and you are making a deal that you will never make a lot of money.
Right.
You know, you go into the public sector, or the private sector rather, and you have the potential to, you know, to have the American dream. If you go into the public sector, you know, you can work as a teacher, you know, I mean, I work in the city of Cambridge, I live in Newton. I can work for 30 years and I'm never going to make over $85,000. It just does not matter. I have 2 master's degrees. I'm not going to do it.
John,
right?
Thank you.
So,
I'm sorry, John, didn't mean to interrupt you, but thank you so much for your call, because I want to actually turn this to David Bernstein and get his response from that. What John's saying has got to be felt by thousands of municipal union members across the state.
Yeah, and it really is a lot of people, a lot of workers, a lot of households across the state, and a lot of people who sympathize with that. You know, it really does draw some battle lines. I happen to essentially agree that they probably should have been squeezed along the way to give a lot more, but that's the job of the municipalities. I think what's happening is that the federal government has had to squeeze, so there's, you know, they've squeezed downwards, giving less money to the states, and so the states have squeezed downward, giving less money to the municipalities. Municipalities don't have anywhere to squeeze, so they have to look at their costs, and their costs are payroll and these benefits, and so they're trying to squeeze it out of that, and so that's the pressure coming to Beacon Hill, give us the power to do that. But I just think that when you're talking about collective bargaining, all of these pieces are part of that bargaining aspect. It's, you know, do we give up, you know, more in pensions for, you know, benefits now in the way of low copays or whatever it might be? So I think it's very troubling to take away pieces of it.
Yeah. Ken? I would also say that, you know, in response to the caller, one other thing you get from working in the public sector that you don't get in the private sector is job security.
Absolutely.
And that's one reason people do work in the public sector. And I would also say that in a way the real problem is not how much employees and employers pay and how they split the cost of health care. It's the escalating cost of the service of health care itself that needs to be constrained. That said, there is some evidence that if you make people pay more for their health care, utilization, how much service, health care services you get, go down. So that would be a slight restraining factor in most cases.
Well, there's a lot to talk about on this issue, and we'll definitely be covering it in the coming days and weeks on Radio Boston. But I do want to move on briefly to Governor Deval Patrick and his new book that's out. He's making the rounds this week, Promoting a Reason to Believe.
Joined by Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. He joins us tonight, not from Massachusetts, but, as you can tell, from Washington.
There is something kind of perverse about the notion of calling into question his background, because he has had the experience of living in the world.
And what I liked especially is that he put the real question to not just to the Republicans, but to the American people.
Which is, what kind of country do we want to live in?
What I did is I had to read Barack Obama's life story mm-hmm. before he came on the show. Mm-hmm. So what I did is just searched and replaced your name with his. I hope that's not a problem.
It was very efficient.
So Ken and David, what do you make of the of Governor Patrick and his new book on the national scene?
Well, you know, he's hustling hard to sell his book and to sell his man for president. Again, re-election for president.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much how he was introduced. Governor Deval Patrick, governor of Massachusetts, and friend of President Barack Obama.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have quite the ring as, you know, FOB, friend of Bill, but, you know, friend of Barack, I guess, you know. And he's entitled to do that. I have to tell you, though, I have a hard time, but, well, as much as I, you know, extend belief to him that he says he's not running for anything ever again. He sure doesn't look like he's not running anything for anything again. And I have to tell you that I always felt that he'd be best suited in the United States Senate. He's gotten better at being governor, but I always felt that temperamentally he was more a legislator, an advocate, a deal maker than an executive. Mm-hmm. But I'll take him at word face value that he's not running for anything else. It just sure looks like it.
David, briefly, your thoughts on the governor?
Yeah, well, he's certainly out there, you know, showing what he's going to be doing for the next year, which is 2 years or whatever it is, stumping for the president. I would make a point that, you know, Barack Obama in his reelect is really, you can tell he's really planning to copy the playbook that Deval Patrick used in getting reelected here. And the speech that Barack Obama gave about budget deficit and how to deal with that was straight out of the Deval Patrick reelect, talking about budgets are not just numbers, it's the people behind the numbers, talking about the vision, the optimistic vision of the future versus the pessimistic right. version being offered by the other side. It was right out of the Deval Patrick playbook.
Interesting. So we're bearing down on our time here. We just got a couple of minutes left for our weekly hubbubs. Adam, you first. What do you got?
My hubbub comes courtesy of the Medford Patch and is as follows. A resolution to ban city councilors from using electronic devices during meetings drew heated debate Tuesday night before ultimately being defeated. This is the Medford City Council. The issue has come to the forefront in other legislative bodies, according to Councillor Bob Penta, who really, really brings the crazy in what I'm about to read. This isn't Bob Penta making this up, Penta said, referring to himself in the third person. I have a brain that God gave me. No one is going to computer me to tell me what to say or do.
Oh my God.
Computer me.
Points for using computer as a verb.
As a verb.
We'll leave it there.
And for Bob Doling himself as well. Ken, your hubbub?
Yeah, not such a lighter note, but for more than 20 years, there are four organizations of journalists of color, black, Latino, Asian, and Native American, that have had a joint conference every 4 years. The organization called itself Unity. Well, this week, the organization essentially fell apart when the National Association of Black Journalists withdrew. The structure of the organization has been that each of the four groups has an equal number of representatives, irrespective of how big their organizations are. And NABJ felt that it was not getting its fair share of money. What I think is interesting about this beyond our profession is that I think if a sociologist were to drill down, they'd find that there were a series of intercultural miscommunications and misunderstandings of the kind this entire country will face as the country gets more diverse.
Interesting. Wow. Even amongst journalists themselves.
Yeah. So-called communicators by profession.
And I mean, those are important organizations, you know, speaking as a white journalist, they're really important organizations. So it's been a development that I'm aware of sort of from a distance, but I don't know the internal politics of it. It's very interesting.
Well, David, you got a couple seconds for your hubbub.
Well, I just wanted to say that it's the 150th. This week marked the 150th anniversary, the sesquicentennial. Really, I just wanted to say the word sesquicentennial of the beginning of the Civil War, Fort Sumter attack. And there's nothing happening in Boston to mark it. I believe that you covered it here on the radio.
Oh, we only devoted like 2/3 of our show to it on Wednesday. But
there's very, very little recognition of it. There's very little, and it seems to be a pattern throughout the North, whereas you have a lot of things going on, not just this week, but all all year, really, throughout the South. And I think that's a real shame because this was not something that happened to the South. This was an American event. It was a major piece of American history. You know, Boston is a place that celebrates history. And Massachusetts played an enormously important role in the Civil War that we should be talking about.
In the South, I believe they still call it the War of Northern Aggression, as well. Well, on historical and liberty-type notes, my hubbub briefly is the fact that the U.S. Postal Service has brought out a new stamp. It's of Lady Liberty. Except the fact that the image on the stamp is of the Lady Liberty in Las Vegas. Not exact.
What?
Not the actual Statue of Liberty in New York City. So United States Postal Service, oops, my bad.
Wow.
That's all we've got for today's Week in Review. Ken Cooper, independent journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner, thank you so much. Adam, thank you as well. And David Bernstein, political reporter for the Boston Phoenix, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.